The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The Philosophy of Art and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Hamilton and the making of our government. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, if Washington made possible a free nation on this continent, Hamilton had the chief share in molding its effective government. Attacked because of his very excellence in fighting force, achieving his great work by sheer power of intellect acting on the minds of other men, Hamilton stands as one of the truly great statesmen of all time. Born in 1757 on the island of Nevis, a British colony, Hamilton, devoted to our cause from its inception, felt wholly American. His finely cultivated mother was partly of Huguenot French ancestry. The romantic story only recently cleared up of her flight from a loveless marriage and brave union with the Scotch James Hamilton was known to her son. She died when Hamilton was 11. His father having left for St. Vincent in search of work, the boy was thrown on his own resources, clerking for some years in Nicholas Kruger's store. A brilliant article the boy wrote on the devastation of St. Croix by a hurricane wakened his mother's relatives to recognize that he had too fine a mind to spend his life in an island clerkship, and they raised money to send him to the mainland for a college education. At 15, he sailed for Boston, made his way to New Jersey, entering a preparatory school at Elizabethtown. In a few months, he felt ready for college, and with little money, knowing he could study intensely, he asked the Princeton authorities if he might go through as fast as possible. There were pedants then as now, so Princeton told him he must follow the regular order. He turned to King's College, New York City, the germ of Columbia University. It had a Tory president and two professors who were quite willing he should go forward as rapidly as he could. So he entered. Hamilton remained in college a scant 2 years, but doing, he tells us, all the work for the A.B. degree and reading deeply in history and government. While in college, he wrote 2 long pamphlets defending the Continental Congress in answer to the Tory Dr. Seabury. Believing instinctively in authoritative government, Hamilton opposed the rioting then on. When a mob gathered to storm the college president's home, Hamilton from the house steps urged it to observe law and order. Dr. Cooper, awakened by the noise, yelled from an upstairs window, "Don't listen to that fellow, he's crazy." Hamilton smiled, continued his speech, while Dr. Cooper was taken to a British ship in safety. At 19, Hamilton was commissioned captain of artillery and used the remaining money brought for his college education to raise and equip his company. He trained it so thoroughly that it was a chief reliance of Washington during the early period of the war. It had the perilous rear guard service in crossing the river after the defeat on Long Island and during the retreat across New Jersey. At the campaign's conclusion, Washington urged Hamilton to resign from field service and serve as his chief secretary. Reluctantly, Hamilton accepted, and for 4 years was Washington's pen and voice, formulating his commander's innumerable documents. Hamilton was eager to get into the field before the fighting stopped, and on resigning as secretary, asked for a commission. He received it as colonel in command of a regiment of light infantry when Washington started south on the last campaign. At Yorktown, the capture of the smaller of the 2 forts was assigned to Hamilton. He crept forward with a small detachment of men, had them lift him on their shoulders, and leaped over among the British inside the fort, taking it almost bloodlessly. Washington reported this feat as one of the most intrepid and courageous of the entire campaign. His personal life was established by Hamilton's marriage at 23 with the lovely Elizabeth Schuyler, daughter of General Schuyler, head of one of the great New York landed families. 8 children were born of the union, to whom Hamilton was playmate companion. He was deeply attached to his wife, and she to him, with unchanging loyalty to his memory after his death, in spite of certain infidelities resulting from Hamilton's strong and not always controlled passions. With the Cornwallis surrender, Hamilton was out of a job. He turned naturally to the law, since his central interest was in problems of government. Isolating himself at Albany for 5 months, he passed his examinations and was admitted to the bar, and in the meantime, just to fix his ideas, had compiled a manual of cases which served several generations of lawyers helpfully. While waiting for the British to evacuate New York, Hamilton served a term in the Continental Congress. His whole effort was to strengthen that weak government, which, unable to collect taxes, was receiving a poor fraction of their assigned quotas from the states, now that fighting had stopped. When the British evacuated New York City, Hamilton entered and opened a law office, rising quickly to leadership of the bar. His disregard of public opinion and devotion to principle were evident in one of his first cases. The peace treaty provided that no action could be taken against Tories who had occupied property in cities held by the British during the war. In 1783, New York State enacted a law permitting such action. The first case called under this conflict was that of a widow whose property had been occupied by British subjects who had paid their rent as prescribed by the authorities. Under the New York law, the widow sued for the rent over again, and public opinion was with her. Hamilton took the defendant's case, making an argument so convincing that the judge decided in favor of the British subjects. There was public uproar. Hamilton's life was in danger. He carried the struggle to the public in the Phocean letters addressed to the considerate citizens of New York, and had won the first fight of nation versus state. Meantime, the country's condition was increasingly desperate, and the nerveless Congress could do nothing. We should recognize that under democracy, the people will get the worst government they're willing to tolerate. And under democracy, the people can get the best government they're willing to strive for. Thus, when things get very bad, there's always the hope the people will wake up and make them better. That happened in those dark years. In 1786, Virginia called a commercial convention to meet at Annapolis. Seeing his chance, Hamilton went as delegate from New York, and with the cooperation of James Madison, won the convention to call another to meet the following year in Philadelphia and make a constitution. Hamilton went home to try to bring in line New York, whose small property-owning vote was controlled by Governor Clinton, strong for state sovereignty. He succeeded in being chosen delegate to the convention, but his associates, Yates and Lansing, were Clinton henchmen, and when the convention abandoned the Articles of Confederation and started to make a constitution, they deserted it, leaving Hamilton minority delegate. When, after the months of wrangling, our compromise constitution was signed and the first copy of it reached New York, there appeared the same day a virulent attack upon it from the pen of Governor Clinton in his official newspaper. Recognizing that something must be done quickly, Hamilton wrote the first of the Federalist papers coming down from Albany in a sloop on the Hudson. He appealed to Jay and Madison to help him. Jay wrote a few papers, Madison some deeply philosophic. But it was Hamilton who took up the Constitution point by point, answering every objection. Those papers did much to win the Union and remain a great treatise on government. The following year, New York held a convention at Poughkeepsie to decide on adopting the Constitution. When it met, 46 of the 57 delegates were opposed. The debate lasted 3 weeks. Hamilton spoke every day and sometimes almost all day, and the sheer power of the man's intellect won the fight, with the Constitution adopted by a majority of 3 votes. Thus, Hamilton put New York in the Union. When Washington became first president, he called his old-time secretary to the Treasury Department. It was a disheartening task, with a huge external and internal debt, much of it accumulated under a rapidly depreciating currency. The situation seemed so hopeless that many urged repudiation, others discrimination, paying only original holders of obligations. Hamilton had expected to report on the floor of the House. They refused to hear him and demanded a written report. He prepared it in 5 days, 20,000 words of argument and more of schedules. He argued that to get the nation on its feet, the first need was to restore the public credit. To that end, every debt, internal and external, should be paid at face value in gold. To repudiate a debt because its ownership has changed, he held as to destroy the very foundation of credit. Thus, he merely applied to the obligations of government the simple moral principles prevailing among just men. Had the world made generally that application, it would not be in the present perilous condition. The report was so admirable that Congress adopted it. Hamilton next proposed that the federal government assume the war debts of the several states and pay them as the debt of the whole people. The significance of this was that if the states retained their debts, they would have the superior taxing power, leaving the federal government standing like the Continental Congress, cap in hand, asking the states please to contribute enough to run the government. Jealousies were so great that this key measure was threatened with defeat. And to save it, Hamilton took his first step down from statesman to politician. He proposed to Jefferson that if he would give the needed Virginia votes for assumption, Hamilton would influence enough Federalist votes to have the capital placed where the Southern leaders wanted it, in the proposed District of Columbia. At that time, Jefferson was not opposed to the measure and cheerfully agreed. That is why the capital is in Washington. And that is why there was a government in it strong enough to survive the Civil War and function effectively to the present hour. Hamilton next proposed a national bank to carry out his funding scheme. Washington drew back and obtained opinions from Jefferson and Randolph declaring the measure unconstitutional. He handed these opinions to Hamilton and asked him to answer them. Hamilton returned with 11,000 words of written argument, completely convincing Washington, who thereafter supported every one of Hamilton's measures for strengthening the federal government. In that paper, Hamilton developed his theory of the implied powers in the Constitution, holding that in assigning functions to the federal government, the makers of the Constitution must have intended to give the power to fulfill those functions. He further held that the federal government, as the government of all the people, was superior to all state governments, which could rightly exercise only those powers specifically reserved to them. Next, he wrote his great paper on manufactures, currently cited as the classic in defense of high protection. I have long wished that some of those so citing it would read it. Hamilton begins with the argument that the only just moral basis of international relations is entire free trade, with no governmental interference. Then he goes on to show the unjust restrictions against our commerce and the need of fostering manufacturers to enable the struggling nation to get on its feet and hold up a self-respecting face to a hostile and threatening world. In both views, he was right. Feeling his major work done, Hamilton resigned in 1795 to resume private practice, needing its earnings for his large family. After taking several homes in New York City, he had gone away out in the country and built the Grange at 142nd Street and 10th Avenue. He could not escape public affairs, however, since he was the brain and heart of the group of men who had made our government. Thus, the logic of events pushed him into being boss of the Federalist Party. As young army officers, Hamilton and Aaron Burr had been comrades. But through the years, Hamilton's distrust of Burr as a self-seeking adventurer had steadily deepened and been expressed to various statesmen. Burr finally challenged Hamilton to a duel, which he felt forced to accept. He spent the intervening time setting his affairs in order, and on two nights, working late, wrote and sealed tender love letters to his wife. Burr spent the time in pistol practice on Long Island. In the duel at Weehawken, July 11, 1804, Hamilton's pistol went off in the air. He had said he would not fire at his enemy. Burr shot to kill. Hamilton, mortally wounded, died the next day, 47 and a half years old. His wife survived him 50 years, spending her long widowhood seeking justice for her husband's memory. When she came to die in 1854, at the age of 97, there was found upon her breast, enclosed in a little bag, the faded paper containing the love verses Hamilton had written to her as fiancé 74 years before.
Hamilton and the Making of Our Government has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Victor Hugo and the Fruit of the French Revolution. Copies of tonight's discussion of Hamilton may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.